Series through the book. This is message number 30 in our overall series. And the title of the message this evening is Mazel Tov, Jacob. So Genesis chapter 29, we'll go start with verse number 1. When Jacob went on his journey and came into the land of the people of the east. So chapter 28 primarily recounts the Lord's appearance to Jacob in a dream. He addressed Jacob directly. He confirmed the covenant with him, just like he had with Abraham and Isaac before him. He affirmed the promise of the land of Canaan to also the multiplication of his seed to a great nation, and that all the nations of the earth would be blessed through the nation from Jacob. So the Lord further promised Jacob concerning his leaving of the land of Canaan that he would be with him, that he would keep him, that he would bring him back to the land of promise, that he would fulfill all of his promises to Abraham and to Isaac and to Jacob. So Jacob, at the end of chapter 28, he is heading into exile, and he is assured by the blessing of Isaac and by the words of the Lord that he is indeed the chosen heir, and God will be with him the way that he was with Abraham and Isaac before him. So now we come to chapter 29, and chapter 29 follows Jacob outside of the land of Canaan. And Jacob had left the land to escape the rage of his brother Esau, but he also left the land to get a wife, to have children, to fulfill the covenant promises to him. Now, once again, we read an account that has some remarkable similarities to some of the previous events. And Jacob, he goes to the same place that Abraham's servant went to when he went to get a wife for Isaac in chapter number 24. Jacob goes about to get a wife without specific instructions for this task, just as Abraham and his servant embarked on this as well. And also in this chapter, God's providence is highlighted just as it was in chapter 24 with the getting of a wife for Isaac. So there are a number of similarities between the two passages and the two events. But there's also some differences between these passages, as we have found to be the case ordinarily. So Jacob sets out with the appearance and the promise of the Lord to go with him, whereas the servant of Abraham, he simply goes forward with Abraham's blessing on him and faith concerning that God would be with him and prosper him. But Jacob actually sets out with the appearance of the Lord and his words that he would bring him back and that he would fulfill all of his promises concerning him, that he would go with him and be with him wherever that he was. So the events in chapter 24 were given more in the light of faith in the sense that they didn't have that sort of assurance before Abraham's servant set out. This account also features something that's not present in that previous account in Genesis 24. And that is Jacob experiencing some of what we would call poetic justice as he reaps some of what he has sown. Now, this chapter does yield some important lessons for Israel, for us today as well. So we want to look at this chapter and going to divide it into three sections. So verses 1 to 14, where Jacob arrives in Haran, in verses 15 to 30, where Jacob marries a wife or two, and in verses 31 to 35, where Jacob starts a family. So we'll start with this first section and Jacob's arrival in Haran. And we'll look at the first three verses. Then Jacob went on his journey and came into the land of the people of the east. And he looked, and behold, a well in the field. And lo, there were three flocks of sheep lying by it. For out of that well they watered the flocks, and a great stone was upon the well's mouth. And thither were all the flocks gathered. And they rolled the stone from the well's mouth and watered the sheep and put the stone again upon the well's mouth in his place. So we're told that Jacob arrived in Haran, or he arrived near to Haran. In fact, He arrives at this well in a field that was near to Haran, the city of Haran at the time. Haran was north of Israel, near the modern-day border of Syria and Turkey. The distance would have been somewhere around 450 miles from Beersheba in the south of Canaan to Haran in the north. And it was a journey that would have taken at least several weeks for Jacob to make on foot. It could take even much more time than that, just depending on conditions and situations that he met with and hindrances that arose. And so he arrives at this field and this well that is near to the city of Haran. And in verse number 3, we're told that it was customary to wait until all of the shepherds had brought their herds for water to the well in order to roll away the stone that covered the well to access the water. Now, at the end of verse number 2, it's added there that this was a great stone that covered the well, indicating obviously that it was a large stone and probably that it was difficult to move. So the custom that they had of waiting was likely to regulate the use of the well, as well as to limit the moving of the large stone out of the way, because it had to have been a difficult endeavor. Let's look at verses 4 to 8 now. And Jacob said unto them, "My brethren, whence be ye?" And they said, "Of Haran are we." And he said unto them, "Know ye Laban, the son of Nahor?" And they said, "We know him." And he said unto them, "Is he well?" And they said, "He is well. And behold, Rachel, his daughter, cometh with the sheep." And he said, "Lo, it is yet high day, neither is it time that the cattle should be gathered together. Water ye the sheep, and go and feed them." And they said, "We cannot, until all the flocks be gathered together, until they roll the stone from the well's mouth. Then we water the sheep." So Jacob inquires of these shepherds. We were told there that when he got to the well, there was three flocks of sheep there already, obviously with their shepherds. And he inquires of these shepherds where they were from, and found out that they were from Haran and that they knew Laban. So Jacob knew that he had arrived where he had wanted to go. And furthermore, they see Rachel obviously coming from a distance with her father's sheep, and they inform Jacob that she's coming and that she's the daughter of Laban, the man that he had asked about. And so then Jacob asks them why they had not watered the sheep, since there was seemed to be plenty of time left in the day. Why had they not gone ahead and watered the sheep and then taken them back to pasture? And they don't really explain, other than to appeal to the customary practice, that was just when they typically did things. Then we look at verses 9 to 14. And while he yet spake with them, Rachel came with her father's sheep, for she kept them. And it came to pass, when Jacob saw Rachel, the daughter of Laban, his mother's brother, and the sheep of Laban, his mother's brother, that Jacob went near and rolled the stone from the well's mouth and watered the flock of Laban, his mother's brother. And Jacob kissed Rachel and lifted up his voice and wept. And Jacob told Rachel that he was her father's brother, that he was Rebekah's son. And she ran and told her father. And it came to pass, when Laban heard the tidings of Jacob, his sister's son, that he ran to meet him and embraced him and kissed him and brought him to the house. And he told Laban all these things. And Laban said to him, "Surely thou art my bone and my flesh." And he abode with him the space of a month. So Moses highlights for us here the aspect of the timing. It says in verse number 9, while he yet spake with them, talking about Jacob speaking with the shepherds while he was talking with them, that Rachel comes up to the well with her father's sheep. And again, this would be another similarity that we would see between the account in chapter 24 and this account here. So Jacob responds quickly at Rachel's coming, and they had already seen her afar off and told her that he was coming. So he rolls this stone away, and he waters the sheep that Rachel had kept. So here again we see a similarity and a dissimilarity. It had been about 100 years earlier when Abraham's servant had come to the well and there met Rebekah. And Rebekah had moved with haste to go and get water for the servant to drink and to get water for all the camels also. And so here, Jacob is the one that rolls away the stone and waters the flock of Laban. Now, the account is told to us in such a way to highlight that Jacob was a strong, hardworking man. Obviously, the moving of this large stone was something that was difficult, and yet he does it himself. Jacob certainly had some flaws. There's no question about that. But being industrious, being hardworking, and being apparently a very strong and well-able-bodied man was certainly not one of his flaws. So he greets Rachel and tells her that he is Rebekah's son. And Rachel went to go and tell her father again. We see all these similarities between what happened in chapter 24 and what's happening here. But she goes and tells her father, and he hurries and gets back to greet Jacob and welcome him into his home. And then we're told that Jacob stayed there and he worked for Laban for a month. And then we get to the real business of the chapter as we get to the second section, verses 15 to 30, where Jacob bargains for Rachel. So let's begin looking here in verses 15 to 20. And Laban said unto Jacob, "Because thou art my brother, shouldest thou therefore serve me for naught? Tell me, what shall thy wages be?" And Laban had two daughters. The name of the elder was Leah, and the name of the younger was Rachel. Leah was tender-eyed, but Rachel was beautiful and well-favored. And Jacob loved Rachel and said, "I will serve thee 7 years for Rachel, thy younger daughter." And Laban said, "It is better that I give her to thee than that I should give her to another man. Abide with me." And Jacob served 7 years for Rachel, and they seemed unto him but a few days for the love he had to her. So Jacob had stayed with Laban now for a month, and obviously he had been working in some capacity, probably with his animals, with his livestock in some capacity. He had been working for him for a month, and so Laban questions him about what his wages should be. Now, at this point, Leah is introduced into the account. Leah is Rachel's older sister, Laban's firstborn daughter. And as we read these verses introducing Leah, we can see that just by the way that Moses writes and presents this to us, that they are written in such a way as to compare the two daughters together. So notice that he writes that Leah was older and Rachel was younger. Leah was tender-eyed and Rachel was beautiful. So everything that he says about them here is in a way of comparing them against each other. Now, when it says that Leah was tender-eyed, it's not entirely certain what that means. There are a couple of primary possibilities, and that the word for tender-eyed could mean weak-eyed, and it could mean that her eyesight was weak, that she didn't have good vision. And that would certainly be an interesting echo of Isaac's blindness and the part it played in Jacob's deception, as we know what comes later, because then here Jacob would be deceived with, rather than him being the deceiver, he would be deceived, and the one with poor eyesight would deceive him rather than he doing the same. So, again, that would certainly be interesting. But her being tender-eyed could also mean that her eyes were weak in a sense of being light-colored, which in that time and that culture was considered less attractive and less appealing than dark eyes. That was much more common in such a culture. Well, either way, and it certainly could possibly be either of those. It could possibly even mean something else. But what we do know the intention is that it is a comparison between Leah and Rachel. And the point is not to indicate that Leah was ugly, and there's nothing that indicates that Leah was ugly. That's certainly not the intention. But rather, the point is that she was not as beautiful as her sister. Again, it is a point of comparison that in terms of their beauty and their appearance, that Rachel was the more beautiful sister. And we can certainly only assume that this was a fact that she was very readily and probably painfully aware of. Now, these verses then, and the way they're presented to us in this matter of comparison, these verses then are foreshadowing this upcoming conflict and competition between these two sisters that is going to carry on certainly much past this chapter. So Jacob suggests to Laban that he will work for 7 years to marry Rachel, the younger daughter. Now, here we have another dissimilarity between these accounts, because in chapter 24, Abraham gave his servant quite a treasure, quite a number of rich gifts, quite a bit of wealth to carry with him. And Isaac sent Jacob out without anything. He goes out and he lays on the open ground. He gathers up some stones for a pillow. He seems to have nothing but whatever it is that he's wearing, and maybe a staff or something that's in his hand. Perhaps maybe a little bit of money or something, but he seemed to have very, very minimal in terms of any sort of provisions. So obviously the servant arrives at the well 100 years prior to this, and he is well stocked with some of the wealth of Abraham, and Jacob shows up and has nothing. Now what that means is that Jacob had no means of paying the dowry for Rachel, paying that bride price. And the bride price was the price that was paid, that would be paid to the family of the woman. Typically, it could be, I've read different figures, but it could be 3 or 4 years of wages in that time that was customary to be given. And this bride price was paid as an insurance policy. And so if the husband perhaps died young, then the family could receive her back, and she would have the use of this money. It was insurance over a number of things. So Jacob had no means of paying such a dowry in order to marry Rachel. So what he's offering then is to work for this bride price. And he suggests the term of 7 years, and it would have been a sort of indentured servitude that he would be working. It would be like he was working to pay off a debt, and he was paying off the debt of the dowry or the bride price in order to marry Rachel. Now, 7 years does seem to be high as far as some of the research and things that I've read. It's hard to know exactly what it might be, but 7 years does seem to be a bit of a high number, more than was customary, but Laban agrees to Jacob's terms. And the time, we're told, that 7 years seemed to be but just a few days to Jacob, indicating on the one hand how much that he loved Rachel, how much that he looked forward to marrying her and life together with her. But there's also a subtle echo here of the words that Rebecca spoke to Jacob back in chapter 27, when she told him that he would go to her brother Laban's house and that he would be there a few days while the anger of Esau was abated. So using this same term. So what we're getting here at the end of verse number 20 is, so far we're getting an indication that everything is working out great. Everything just seems to be falling right in place. And so he arrives in Haran. He meets people that are able to give him information that he needs right away. And at just the right time, well, here comes Rachel, and he meets her, and he goes back to Laban, and he gets a good reception. He's able to live and work for Laban for a month to sort of prove his worth and to earn his keep. And then he's able to make this arrangement to work for 7 years to marry the younger daughter, Rachel, that he is so much in love with. And by the end of chapter 20, just a few days, again, it's just an echo back that Rebecca's plan was he would go there and just be there a few days until he would return. In other words, just a short time. And so it seems like everything is going that way to fall right in place. And then, of course, that's when everything takes a pretty steep dive. So we start now in verse number 21 through 30, and we see how this worked out. And Jacob said unto Laban, "Give me my wife, for my days are fulfilled, that I may go in unto her." And Laban gathered together all the men of the place and made a feast. And it came to pass in the evening that he took Leah his daughter and brought her to him, and he went in unto her. And Laban gave unto his daughter Leah Zilpah, his maid, for an handmaid. And it came to pass that in the morning, behold, it was Leah. And he said to Laban, "What is this thou hast done unto me? Did not I serve with thee for Rachel? Wherefore then hast thou beguiled me?" And Laban said, "It must not be so done in our country, to give the younger before the firstborn." Fulfill her week, and we will give thee this also for the service which thou shalt serve with me yet 7 other years. And Jacob did so, and fulfilled her week, and he gave him Rachel, his daughter, to wife also. And Laban gave to Rachel, his daughter, Bilhah, his handmaid, to be her maid. And he went in also unto Rachel, and he loved also Rachel more than Leah, and served with him yet 7 other years. So after Jacob fulfills this 7 years of labor that seemed to be just a short amount of time for the love and the anticipation that he had for Rachel, after that he fulfills this 7 years, he speaks to Laban, and Laban arranges all of the customary feast and ceremony of sorts. And of course, we don't really know a whole lot about what those ceremonies would have involved in that ancient time. But obviously, there was a feast and a week of feast for the marriage, and all this was customary and was arranged that way. Only Laban substituted the elder daughter, Leah, for the younger daughter, Rachel, when it was time for the wedding night. Now, when we go back to think about how that Rebekah and Jacob conspired together to deceive Isaac in order for Jacob to gain the blessing, Moses gave us quite a bit of detail there about the logistics of how all that worked. So we know Jacob's deception. You know, he went and he took the goats, and Rachel prepared them the way that Isaac liked, the way that would taste like the wild game that he so much savored. She takes the goat hair and she puts it on Jacob, and she gives him Jacob's clothes to wear, and so that he'll smell like Esau, rather. I think I kept saying Jacob, but Esau's clothes, and all of these things to get Jacob prepared. And he goes in and he pulls it all off pretty well, except for the voice, and Isaac has a little bit of uncertainty there about it, but nevertheless he proceeds. All right, so we're given all those details about the logistics of how that deception was pulled off, but here we're just only told of the substitution, and it wasn't discovered until the morning. And so how that all worked, we just don't really know. Obviously, we can make a bunch of guesses, but that's really about all they would be. So we're just not told that. So we do see, though, another one of those similarities, and this is the one that goes on the side of the poetic justice. Because here, Jacob was deceived in the dark of night, just as he deceived Isaac, who was in the darkness of blindness. And so this is sort of coming back on Jacob's own head. Well, of course, Jacob was upset. So he questions Laban about, you know, what he's done. Why have you done this? And he actually uses the same word root that Isaac uses to describe Jacob's trick to Esau when he said, "Your brother has come with subtlety and has taken your blessing." And he says, "You have beguiled me," is what Jacob accused Laban of doing. And of course, Laban defends himself, but he defends himself by appealing to custom. He doesn't deny that he deceived and tricked Jacob into marrying his oldest daughter, Leah. But what he did was according to the custom of their country. So Laban concedes then afterward to give him also Rachel. You can marry the younger as well, but there will be two conditions. So the first condition was that he had to fulfill this marriage week, this whatever the custom was pertaining to the wedding and the marriage and all of that, this week feast. He had to fulfill this for Leah. And the other agreement was, or condition, was that he had to agree to work another 7 years to then pay for the dowry for Rachel, just as he had done that was applied to Leah. And so Jacob agrees to these terms, and after the week of feasting and such with the wedding with Leah, then he was given Rachel also. And verse 30, it says, "He went in also unto Rachel, and he loved also Rachel more than Leah, and served with him yet 7 other years. So verse number 30 then foreshadows what is to come in the home life of Jacob. And again, when Leah was introduced with Rachel, There was the introduction was made with all of these comparisons, indicating this sibling rivalry and competition between the sisters. And now we read that as they have both now married Jacob, that Jacob loved Rachel more than he did Leah. And that means that he preferred Rachel over Leah. And then we get the beginning of Jacob's family here when we look at verses 31 to 35 that finish out this chapter. And when the Lord saw that Leah was hated, he opened her womb, but Rachel was barren. And Leah conceived and bare a son, and she called his name Reuben, for she said, "Surely the Lord hath looked upon my affliction. Now therefore my husband will love me." And she conceived again and bare a son and said, "Because the Lord hath heard that I was hated, he hath therefore given me this son also." And she called his name Simeon. And she conceived again and bare a son and said, "Now this time will my husband be joined unto me, because I have borne him three sons." Therefore was his name called Levi. And she conceived again and bare a son, and she said, "Now will I praise the Lord." Therefore she called his name Judah and left barren. So the first thing that we encounter here in verse number 31 is that the Lord saw that Leah was hated. Now, this is really the first direct mention that we have of the Lord so far in this episode. And that obviously doesn't mean that he did not know, wasn't aware, or wasn't involved in any way in things that have taken place. But now we get this first mention of the Lord, his knowledge, and also his action. But it says that he knew that Leah was hated. And that word is used a few times concerning Leah. Now, the word itself that is used is a word that certainly can literally mean hated, detested, despised, abhorred. It's a word that, in fact, in its more literal usage, is a word that is applied to enemies. But the word can be used more figuratively in terms of a comparison. And so here the word is used in verse 31 after the statement was made in verse number 30 that Jacob loved Rachel more than he did Leah. Now, we're not told here, or really as we go on, we're not told how that Jacob having more love for Rachel than he did for Leah, how that was manifested in their relationships, how that was manifested in their home and their family. I mean, we're just not told how that was seen in the relationships that Jacob had with his wives. But the more figurative use of this word does make sense in the context in which it is presented. Jacob loved and preferred Rachel over Leah. So it's not a statement that he abhorred or detested Leah or that she had become his enemy, but it is simply a statement once again that shows the comparison between the two sisters and the fact that the younger was preferred and chosen and loved over and above the older. Now, Moses gives us this fact that the Lord opened her womb. He saw that she was hated. He saw that she was not preferred. She was not chosen. She was not loved as Rachel was. And the Lord opens her womb. And then we go on reading of how that she bore four sons to Jacob, obviously in a pretty short amount of time. And this was done in light of the fact, in other words, the Lord opened her womb to bear these sons. And this is done, we're told, in light of the fact that she was loved less than her younger sister. And she bore these four sons, Reuben, Simeon, Levi, and Judah. And with each birth, even in their names, as we are told, it stressed that Leah hoped to gain Jacob's affection. And of course, once again, as you compare the two sisters together, Leah is always searching for and desiring and wanting Jacob's affection, like what he has for Rachel. Rachel, on the other hand, has the affection from Jacob, but she desires to have the children that Leah has given unto Jacob. But to this point in the account, she is yet barren and has not had any children. So obviously, when we read this chapter, and again, we get quite a turn as you get there past verse number 20. Everything seems to be working out really well, and then all of a sudden we have all kinds of problems. We have Laban who is deceiving Jacob, and then we have Leah and Rachel and how all of that worked and how the substitution and all those things took place. You know, we're just really not told the details about that, but nevertheless, everything about this just speaks of conflict. And we have noted that there's just this theme of conflict that running through the book of Genesis, starting all the way back there with Cain and Abel, and then continuing forward. And oftentimes that conflict presents those obstacles, presents those hindrances to God's promises being fulfilled. So as we look at this chapter, and we're fully turning now to the story of Jacob that's going to track through the rest of the book of Genesis, not only does this theme of conflict continue, but it's actually escalated. In fact, as we go on following the story of Jacob's family, we're going to see that conflict taken up to another level. Now, also as we read this chapter, much like we found in reading Genesis chapter 24, when Abraham sent his servant to go and get a wife for Isaac. Obviously, that was a much longer account. A lot more details were given in that account. But one of the primary observations of Genesis chapter 24 is that God's providence is highlighted in that chapter. God's providence is really the primary message of that chapter. And it is the same way here. We don't see anything of God intervening until, of course, you get to the end and him mentioning that he opened Leah's womb. But most of the events in this chapter are events that happen in the normal course of life and in the normal course of providence. So other than the fact that Jacob had this promise that as he went into this land, that God would be with him while he was there, and God would bring him back again, and God would fulfill all the promises that have been made. Jacob did have that, which the servant didn't have when he went into that same land to get Isaac a wife. But Jacob, just like that servant, didn't have any specific instructions for this particular moment. He wasn't told what he was supposed to do. Yes, the Lord appears in this dream to Jacob, but he doesn't tell him what he's supposed to do here in the house of Laban and concerning Rachel and Leah and all of these things. He's not given that. He's not given any miraculous happenings. He's not given any great signs. He's not given any of those things. So again, he's having to go on the revelation that he has, the what he has received, what he has understood, what he's seen of faith in Abraham and in Isaac before him, and he has to go trusting in God. God said, I'm going to be with you, I'm going to keep you, I'm going to bless you, I'm going to bring you back, I'm going to fulfill all these promises. So he simply had to go in faith, believing that God was going to prosper his journey. So we have a strong message about God's providence, just that normal, ordinary course of events in life. And we get two primary lessons that emerge concerning God's providence in this chapter. Now, one of those is going to be obviously the wisdom principle of sowing and reaping. I believe that even Steve was talking about this in Sunday school this morning. And it's just all through the Bible. And sometimes it's stated explicitly that you're going to reap what you sow. Sometimes it is stated that explicitly. Other times it's just simply shown. One of those, again, the great classic example of Haman in the book of Esther, where he reaps exactly what he sowed. So sometimes it's implicit, sometimes it's explicit. But here we see it, it's more implicit, but nevertheless, it's very obvious when you think about this account and you compare it with those previous events again. So, the principle is that when we stray from the paths of righteousness and wisdom, there are consequences for our choices and our actions. So, in the course of God's providence, we are always making choices. We're always taking actions. We're always choosing paths through this life. We're always choosing the way that we're going to go. And we come to splits and forks and all of those kind of things. And we're always choosing. And just like the book of Proverbs tells us, there's always voices that are calling out to us, trying to compel us to go one way or another. And one of the reasons why we need wisdom is to be able to discern wisdom from folly. What we're being told, is it evil? Is it righteous? Is this the way of God or not? So just like with the situation with Jacob, when we stray from that right way, when we stray from those right paths, which can obviously be seen in some of Jacob's dealings, his dishonest dealings, when we stray from that path, there are consequences for our choices and for our actions. That does not mean that God has forsaken us or that God is against us. There's just no question that Jacob is reaping some of what he has sown earlier in his life when you look at this account and the way that Laban is dealing with him. There's just no doubt that this is coming back on him. But God had promised him before he got there, I'm going to be with you and I'm going to keep you. I'm swearing this promise to you just as I did to Abraham and to Isaac and now to you. I'm going to fulfill all of these promises. And yet Jacob gets into this situation where he begins to reap some negative consequences. So again, what do we learn about providence? That is such an important message for Jacob, for Israel after him, and even for us today, is that there are consequences for the way that we choose to go. There are consequences for that. And we will suffer consequences for choosing the wrong way. But that doesn't mean that God has forsaken us or that God is against us. God had not forsaken Jacob. That's one of the things he promised he would not do. I will not leave you, is what he said to Jacob, even though God obviously knew that Jacob was going to endure some of these consequences. Now, the next lesson concerning providence that comes out of a chapter like this is that God being with us means that in his providence, he is fulfilling his plan and not our plans. And that's actually good for us because God's word will not fail and he will keep all his promises. So again, as you go through the account and everything just seems to be falling right into place, doors are opening, all these sort of things, just falling right into place for Jacob. Everything is just lining up. And he makes this arrangement to be able to work for Rachel. And he's just thrilled to do it. Says 7 years of labor will just be a few days to him because of what he is anticipating his life together with Rachel, whom he loves. Everything just seems to be falling into place. But then in God's providence, Jacob begins to reap some of what he has sown. Well, again, the fact that God is with us means that in his providence, his will is being worked out. God being with us, God not forsaking us, doesn't mean that God's working out our plans. Doesn't mean that God is working out what we want to do. Now, granted, hopefully there are certainly times, and as we grow in grace and knowledge, hopefully there's more and more of these times when our plans coincide. We want what God's will is. And hopefully we experience that more and more as we go along. But nevertheless, God being with us doesn't mean that he's with us to fulfill all of our hopes and dreams and desires and plans and so on. He's fulfilling his purpose. And the point is, that's actually better for us. That's actually better for us. In fact, that's a big part of the assurance that we have of salvation. That's what Paul is arguing in his letter to the Romans, that God's word does not fail, that God is working out his purposes, and he works all things together for good to them that love him, who are the called according to his purpose. And he goes down all that list in Romans chapter 8 at the end of all of those things. He says, these will not separate us from the love of Christ. God being with us means that in these things, Paul says, we are more than conquerors. So that is a good thing for us. It was a good thing for Jacob that God wasn't with Jacob merely to work out his plans. God was with Jacob to fulfill God's plans. And if I were to add a third lesson to the lessons of providence that we learn in a chapter like this, it would be that God being with us in his providence doesn't mean that everything is going to go smoothly from our perspective. And I think we can fall into that trap, into that way of thinking very easily. Oh, well, if God is with us, then that's going to mean all these things are going to fall in place like they did in the first half of the chapter. And then everything just started falling out of place when you get to the rest of the chapter, and it doesn't stop there. It's going to continue on. So God being with us in his providence doesn't mean that everything is always going to be smooth. Everything's always going to be easy. Everything's always going to seem to just fall right in place. But rather, once again, God is committed to fulfilling his word. Just as he told Jacob, I will fulfill all that I have spoken concerning you.